and then he found her stabbed to death in the men's bathroom. All she had on was her socks. And I'd never been in trouble. I don't have any record. I didn't have traffic tickets, you know, being a mailman, driving a postal vehicle, you lose your job.
She actually kept a diary of all her sex partners and all people that she was sweet on. And Ray was one of the people that she was sweet on that's detailed in that.
They had an expert come in, said that my teeth were unique, that the marks on her body matched my teeth. One of them said I was supposed to meet her that night and help her close. Last people to see her was her girlfriends who were leaving to go to an after-hours bar.
And this judge did not do that. To the contrary, said that there is real doubt about whether Ray was the actual person who committed the crime.
On the morning of December 29, 1991, the body of 36-year-old Kim Ancona was found, nude, in the men's restroom of the Phoenix, Arizona bar where she worked. Ancona had been fatally stabbed, and the perpetrator left behind little physical evidence. Blood at the crime scene matched the victim's type, and saliva on her body came from someone with the most common blood type. There was no semen, and no DNA tests were performed. Investigators relied on bite marks on the victim's breast and neck. Upon hearing that Ancona had told a friend that a regular customer named Ray Crone was to help her close up the bar the previous night, police asked Crone to make a styrofoam impression of his teeth for comparison. On December 31, 1991, Crone was arrested and charged with murder, kidnapping, and sexual assault. The scientific validity of the bite mark analysis is now widely questioned, but in 1991, it was considered a cutting-edge forensic technique. But today we know numerous people across the United States have been wrongly convicted because of this technique. For his part, Ray Crone was stunned by his arrest.
Yeah, it was a local neighborhood bar. I mean, I was in Phoenix, Arizona. I grew up in Pennsylvania, but I went to service in 1980. I got to Phoenix and got out of the Air Force after 6 years of active duty and stumbled around for a dive. I'd only been there a few months, so I didn't really have any references or anything. And anyway, I got a job with the post office by 1985, and between where my house was and my post office, which was only about 4 miles away, was this bar, CBS. I'd started going to, been going for about 2 months. The owner came in on a Sunday morning, found the night manager had been, first off, he looked around and noticed that his money in the cash register was there. His safe was open and no cash was taken, but the place had been cleaned and stacked. He was upset. The front door hadn't been locked. He looked around why his manager didn't close up and lock up, and then he found her stabbed to death in the men's bathroom. All she had on was her socks. And, of course, the police came and initiated an investigation under the assumption it had something to do with her. It wasn't a robbery or break-in. And so they questioned co-workers. One of them said, I was supposed to meet her that night and help her close. Last people to see her was her girlfriends who were leaving to go to an after-hours bar. She had got a call from the boss telling her that she needed to come in early and open up, so she couldn't go. I was not there. Nevertheless, the police came and questioned me. The next 2 days, they noticed I had a protruding tooth in the front. 2 days after the murder, I was arrested. A local medical examiner who had recently been studying bite mark evidence, he wasn't an expert, but he had been had a mentor that was a board-certified forensic odontologist. Anyway, they got the arrest warrant and arrested me for murder, kidnapping, and sexual assault just 2 days after the murder. It was New Year's Eve, 1991, going into 92. And I'd never been in trouble. I don't have any record. I didn't have traffic tickets, you know, being a mailman, driving a postal vehicle, you lose your job. But anyway, I had nothing to worry about. I told my folks not to worry back in Pennsylvania. I didn't do anything. I was home in bed. I had a roommate that knew that. I got a court-appointed attorney. Just 7 months later, I'm in trial. I find out that it was all about a bite mark.
Crone's attorney, Alan Simpson, said what led police to initially suspect Crone was that the victim, Kim Ancona, kept a detailed journal of her sexual partners, and Ray Crone was among those listed.
She actually kept a diary of all her sex partners and all people that she was sweet on. And Ray was one of the people that she was sweet on that's detailed in that. And then as the investigation...
Wait a minute. Let's back up here. This woman kept a book of all the people she slept with?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, pretty much she did.
I've never heard of such a thing. Have you?
Not to my knowledge, no. I mean, I have never... I've never had that come across in one of my cases before, and never had my partner take out a book and say, hey, let me add your name to this list.
I got to ask, was it a very long book?
I wouldn't want to make a disparaging comment. I mean, there was a number of names that was in the book. And again, Ray's name was in the book, Kim was new to the position of closing the bar at night, and she had mentioned to a coworker who had called Kim earlier that evening to see if she wanted to have the coworker come in to help her close. Kim said, no, don't worry about it. Ray's coming by. And so that was, they looked then, who's Ray? And then they go into the book and they see that Ray, and they identify the Ray's being as Ray Crone. So the focus begins very quickly to be turned to Ray Crone. When detectives have contact with Ray, they notice he's got very, very unique dentition. You know, his teeth were, frankly, they were all messed up from a either car or motorcycle accident that broke his jaw years ago. And so he had some really screwed up teeth. There lies, as you've probably read about already, about the bite mark on the breast. You read about that?
Yes, I have.
Yep, there you go. So what now follows is that you get the police get a search warrant to go ahead and require Ray to do an impression on some foam board.
Ray Crone was being tried for capital murder, which can result in either a sentence of death or life imprisonment.
They had an expert come in, said that my teeth were unique, that the marks on her body matched my teeth, and that it happened at the time of death in just a 3.5-day trial. I had a defense attorney, didn't do anything. He was paid $5,000 to represent me. As I tell people, you can't get a divorce for $5,000. So he didn't do anything. I'm dumbstruck. I'm dumbfounded how I can convict an innocent person. Then they sentenced me to death, called me a monster, the snaggletooth killer, an unremorseful, you know, homicidal maniac thing. And I got a death sentence. And, you know, I kind of thought, well, you might as well kill me. I'm 35 years old now. Everything I stood for, believed in, you know, in America, is gone. I could not believe how this trial went, you know, the coverage in the papers and stuff. And I went right to death row in just 11 months from the time of my arrest. So 11 months, I'm sitting on death row in Arizona in isolation, a 6x8 size cell, some concrete floors. And I got out of that cell 3 times a week for 2 hours to go out in a cage out in the desert, 10 feet square and 10-foot high fencing to be outside, at least out of my cell. I told my folks, you know, before that I hadn't done it. Even after my conviction, they believed in me. They stood by me. Mom sent the Bible into me. I found strength in the stories of, like, Job and Jonah. And also realized I'm going to fight this system. I had to know this system. I started going to the law library. And I survived in there almost three years. My appeals came back. The Arizona Supreme Court ordered a new trial. They said the prosecution had withheld evidence the day before trial.
But the new trial wasn't the vindication that he hoped.
By now, of course, my family had come and visited me from Pennsylvania. They'd seen me in shackles, handcuffed to the table with one hand let loose so I could pick up a phone to talk to my mom through a plexiglass window, see the tears in my mom and my little sister's eyes. And they knew this wasn't going to go away. Even when I told them first, don't worry, I didn't do this, they knew that Arizona had executed a number of people while I was on death row. I believe 5 or 6 of them had been executed. And so they mortgaged their house, cashed in some retirement funds that they had through their work, some local friends. I'm from a small town there. I mean, my parents went to the school with the parents of my friends that I went to school with. So some of them actually gave their income tax return checks to my folks. And we found an attorney out of California. We couldn't come near the hundreds of thousands of dollars that, you know, cost for a capital murder case. But he was familiar with my case. He didn't believe in this bite mark stuff. And he was also experienced in DNA, a guy named Chris Plourd from San Diego. And he said, look, just let me take this case. I believe in Ray. I you know, just cover the expenses. And so my second trial started in February of 1996. And in comparison, it lasted 7 weeks. Over 500 exhibits were introduced. We had 3 bite mark experts testify for the defense. A wonderful day came, and my folks came out from Pennsylvania, stayed in a friend's camper in the backyard there, and come to trial each day. Some of my friends would get off work on certain days to hear testimony. But one of the biggest days was when we had a DNA testing. At first day, they denied they had any DNA. And then my attorney said, no, we got the records here show that you did do testing. Oh, yes, that's right. We used it up. He said, no, I got records here. It shows you sent it to a lab in Colorado. Oh, that's right. They used it up. No, they still have it up there. It was taken and given to Dr. Blake out in California, who had started that PCR or where you cloned DNA. He was the one that originated. He actually testified in OJ's trial. But it came back that the saliva from the bite mark that I'm supposed to have made was not my DNA. No way, no how. So you can imagine how wonderful that sounded to me and my family in that courtroom that day. Finally, there's the truth. But I still didn't realize, I still didn't understand how this death penalty works for prosecutors. I mean, this is a win-at-all-cost game for them. This is how they achieve advancement, career, you know, their forward momentum for anything on into becoming head district attorneys to attorney generals to governors even is on getting convictions of death penalties. And this prosecutor closing argument stood in front of that jury, and this was in 1996, OJ's trial had just been over, DNA was still a little confusing, told them to ignore that, disregard it, it has no bearing on the facts. We know who did this. He's sitting right here in this courtroom, points over at me, says, you know, you're responsible for Kim and her family, points to the family there in the courtroom to see that justice is done. That DNA has no bearing in this case. She's a waitress that was just transferred there by accident from somebody's glass or bottle. The jury was out for 3.5 days this time and came back and found me guilty again.
At the second sentencing, the judge, James McDougall, expressed skepticism.
The second trial judge, and imposing a life sentence on Ray after trial number two, indicated that there was serious doubt about whether or not Ray was the person who committed the crime.
And I'm going to ask a stupid question here.
Yeah.
Why on earth did he just give a directed verdict then?
It's not a stupid question at all. It's a very good question.
And if you think there's a doubt there, then it's a reasonable doubt.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, the trial judge is supposed to pay attention, as clearly this judge had done during the course of the trial, pay good attention as he was supposed to do and did do. And they tell judges that, look, you're the 13th juror, and you may go ahead and grant the new trial as the 13th juror if you think that the verdict is not supported by the evidence. And in the special verdict that was provided by, given by this judge, really gave all kinds of reasons why, okay, well, why didn't you step up to the plate as the 13th juror and grant him a new trial sua sponte? You could have done that. He didn't do that. But when I come and get involved in the case and post-conviction, I mean, the first thing that, one thing you do is you look at that special verdict, and I had great regard for the judge whose name I can't remember, and I said to myself, this is really weird. I mean, clearly, had Ray Crone done the things that the jury said he had done, then there was the findings were there to support a death verdict as the original trial judge Jeff Hotham had imposed. And this judge did not do that. To the contrary, said that there is real doubt about whether Ray was the actual person who committed the crime. I mean, that just gets under your craw and kind of like, well, what the hell over here? This is something that's wrong.
The case didn't end there. Saliva was recovered from the bite mark on Kim Ancona's breast. For 6 years following his second conviction, Crone's lawyers fought to have a DNA test conducted on the saliva. Eventually, a judge ordered the test.
And we petitioned the courts to have testing done on that DNA. And of course, it was objected to by the prosecution, said it was a wild goose chase, a fishing expedition, said I've been convicted twice of a jury of my peers, overwhelming evidence of my guilt. You know, there's no reason for this DNA testing. Thankfully, that judge, it was not a judge that sat on my trial, that judge that moved on, but this judge decided to allow that DNA testing done. He ordered the Phoenix Police Department to do that testing, which was now had its own accredited DNA laboratory. But most fortuitous of all was the fact that it also had now had access to the CODIS, the National Data Bank of DNA samples from all around the country. At that time, there was about 15,000 of Arizona samples alone, besides the rest of the other 49 states. So when DNA was extracted from the pants and underwear, it was the same DNA. It did not match me or Kim, the local lab technician. And I say, you go, girl, God bless this overachiever, because on her own, it wasn't ordered by the courts, but on her own, she put it in the National Data Bank. And it wasn't her DNA, it wasn't my DNA. And so when this lab technician put it in the National Data Bank right there, it came back with a match. Matched a man that was currently serving a 10-year sentence for having sexually assaulted a child just 3 months after the murder. A man who at the time of the murder was actually out of parole after serving, some years for a sexual assault on a woman. He was paroled to his mom's house, which was just a few blocks down the road from the bar. I was released, and he was charged with the crime.
Folks, a while back, RX Bars came to me and they wanted me to sample the product and give a testimonial. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, I don't know if I can do that because I gave up all sweets 5.5 years ago. And I think these RX Bars are probably going to count as sweets. And then I looked at the ingredients. They have egg whites, dates, and nuts. Those are the basic ingredients of all RX Bars. And I'm thinking, that doesn't sound like candy. That sounds healthy. In fact, they don't have any added chemicals or sugars, or they don't need fillers at all. It's just very basic, healthy goodness that you're getting here. Now, RX Bars believe in the power of transparency. They build things the right way. They let their core ingredients speak for themselves, right on their packaging. You're likely to recognize RX Bar at the shelf. They're the ones that have the egg whites, protein and dates to bind, and nuts for texture. And they have all kinds of other delicious ingredients like unsweetened chocolate, real fruit, and spices like sea salt or cinnamon. Turns out real food ingredients actually taste really good, and they do taste delicious. Let me tell you that. Whether you like sweet or savory, chocolate, or fruit flavors, there's definitely an RX Bar for you. RX Bars come in 14 delicious flavors: mango pineapple, chocolate hazelnut, peanut butter and berries, chocolate sea salt, which is my absolute favorite, coconut chocolate, mixed berry, blueberry, maple sea salt, apple cinnamon, mint chocolate chip, peanut butter chocolate, and coffee chocolate. RX Bars are gluten-free, soy-free, and dairy-free. There are no artificial flavors or colors or preservatives or fillers. RX Bars are great for a number of occasions. You know, I just went down to Texas this past week to investigate a school shooting, and I so wish I had some RX Bars to pack with me when I got on the airplane because they're great to snack on. But they're also great for breakfast on the go. They're great to take to the office for a snack for that 3 p.m. slump. They're even great to throw in a backpack for a bike ride or a hike, or to eat right before or after a workout. Remember, egg white stands out as a source of protein that is easy for your body to absorb. You know, and I just love this product. I enjoy it, and I order it regularly for myself and my family. I highly recommend this product to you. So, if you'd like a 25% off your first order, visit rxbar.com/suspect and enter the promo code suspect at checkout. Again, for your first order, you can get 25% off. Visit rxbar.com/suspect and enter the promo code suspect at checkout. One more time, folks. For 25% off your first order of RX Bars, go to rxbar.com/suspect and enter the promo code suspect at checkout. Folks, we're joined today by Michelle Ben-Simon, our narrator and a true crime buff from Canada. And I just want to say welcome, Michelle.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. And I understand you had a just returned from an interesting trip.
I did. I was just in Israel for 2 weeks, and it was fantastic and beautiful and confusing and all the things that I think it should be when you're going that far away.
Well, great. We're glad to have you back. And we're looking at the case of Ray Krohn. What was your impression when you were looking at this case?
I was very surprised and kind of thinking about the way that evidence gets tested or doesn't get tested, and how it seems like having any sort of evidence and DNA testing is a great way to rule something out early on and move on. And again, the person who did it, you know, spent so long being free, and who knows what else, you know, they did in that time. And I think that's often just one of the most tragic things, is that that person just can continue. And yeah, it's tragic. Who knows what else he did.
Yeah, and I kept thinking about that. I mean, this guy's a serial sex offender. He lived a couple blocks away from the bar where this happened. And why didn't the police look at him in the first place is what kept running through my mind. But then they focus in on Ray right away, and this guy's never committed a crime. I mean, he's had a clean record. He just got out of the service. He had a lot going for him. Basically, they focused in on him, and I'm going to show my perplexion here, because this woman kept a diary of all of her sex partners, and his name was in there. Okay, tell me, Michelle, does that strike you as odd?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I guess I can't understand what kind of person she was. I don't know if it kind of gives us an indication of her behavior or anything like that. For me, for my opinion, it's kind of like a strange thing to do. And his name being in there, just how do you pick out one name and decide that this is the person who committed the crime without any other evidence besides being amongst a number of other names?
Yeah, I don't quite get that. I mean, he had been at the bar that day and helped the day before with closing. But, you know, besides that, there really wasn't anything that would give any direction in that way towards him. And they relied so heavily on this whole concept of bite mark analysis, which is total junk science. I mean, I come to that conclusion. I mean, I've seen so many wrongful convictions that we've looked at in this podcast that have been based on the idea that bite marks are just like fingerprints. And, you know, as somebody was pointing out to me, it's not like you are looking at a peanut butter sandwich somebody's taken a bite out of and looking at like, oh, it's like a perfect indentation. You're talking about somebody who is biting human flesh as it's thrashing around. It's not a perfect indentation. It's not something
it's not
you
a
can
jaw.
Look at.
It's not a sculpture of someone's jaw. It's not a fingerprint that's softly pressed on a piece of paper. It can't be accurate.
Exactly. I mean, this is something that's happening as an act of violence. And you can't expect that it's going to be a perfect indentation or a sculpture of the person's mouth. But what's interesting is they had DNA from that bite, the saliva. And the prosecution, after the conviction, when DNA technology started becoming more and more prevalent and more accurate, more accurate, more sensitive, they kept fighting to have the to keep the saliva evidence from being tested. And it's like, why? Aren't you concerned about if somebody's wrongly serving time in prison? I mean, it just struck me as bizarre. I mean, we're not talking about they fought it for a few months. They fought it for years.
Yeah.
And then when the evidence finally comes out and it links to a sex offender and totally exonerates Ray Crone, the prosecution got on the television and said, oh, we owe Mr. Crone an apology. And that was the extent of it. And Crone said, you know, when I was brought up, if you're going to apologize to somebody, you say it to their face. He said, they never said they're sorry to me. They said they got on the news and said they're sorry to an audience, but they never extended that courtesy to him. And it's like, wow.
And he seems to be speaking up about it a bit more now, right? Ray Crone, I saw that he talks about his time, and more so, I think, than even other people that we've encountered in other cases.
And one nice thing is, well, he didn't get an apology from the prosecutor. He didn't get an apology from the police detectives that worked the case. He did get an apology from the state of Arizona. They passed a resolution in the legislature while he was standing there apologizing to him for what happened, which I thought was really kind of cool. But
yeah,
it also speaks volumes about the people in law enforcement that they couldn't own up to their mistake to him. You know, and I just think that's really unfortunate. I mean, I just think it says a lot about who these people are and their personal character. So I guess what runs through my mind is, how prevalent do you think these type of cases are out there?
Probably very.
I got to think there's a lot of other Ray Crones locked up in American prisons.
Absolutely.
I mean, I just look at it and I'm thinking, you know, it just boggles the mind. And he is very fortunate in the sense that there was DNA evidence that exonerated him.
That exactly.
There was no wiggle room that somebody else could have done this. It pointed not only away from him, but towards somebody who is a serial sex offender who having committed this crime. But what about those poor folks out there who didn't have DNA linked to their case, but were convicted under the same kind of circumstances? I mean, you got to think about that. And it's kind of scary that there are innocent people locked up in prison for crimes they didn't commit. And we have a system that is very much based on, doesn't give very many opportunities to clear their name. I mean,
because he's lucky that he had family, that he had people who were going to bat for him outside of prison. I mean, there's probably so many people who, you know, get pinned on crimes, who don't have family, who don't have the finances or the means or the education to be able to start the process, get a lawyer that is actually worthwhile, who will fight for them. And then, you know, like, I can't even think of how many people can't even begin the process, let alone all the people who begin the process, but there's no actual evidence and they never get exonerated.
Yeah, you know, and this is one of the things I really do like about Innocence Projects out there is they can function like Ray's family did here and come forward with quality lawyers who are willing to advocate for, and a lot of times these lawyers are doing it on a pro bono basis. They're doing it for free, but they think they're so committed to seeing justice done. And I think that is such a cool thing that we have that happening. But gosh, the bigger question that comes to mind is, should these convictions be taking place in the first place? We allegedly have a system where you're innocent until proven guilty, but frankly, having covered a lot of trials, I think jurors sit there and often look at the person and say, well, if he was innocent, he wouldn't be here in the first place. I mean, there's a presumption of guilt by a lot of jurors when they start a trial.
Yeah, and then all the lawyers sort of pointing and exaggerating, and these are, a lot of times, jurors are just, you know, civilians who are very impressionable, especially in a courtroom where somebody is just hammering down information and they know exactly how to word things to persuade a jury.
That was the most shocking thing to me, is I always thought that before I started covering courts, that the people that were allowed to really exaggerate and come up with far-fetched theories were the defense attorneys. I mean, that was always my impression from watching the news and doing these things. But then I started covering these cases. A lot of times the prosecution's doing that. I mean, they're ascribing motivations for why somebody did something and that may or may not be based in any fact, but they'll just come up with it out of whole cloth. And sadly enough, a lot of jurors just right buy into that. They don't view it as speculation or anything else. They just view it as, well, that's part of the facts of the case. You know, this is why he committed the crime. Well, you know, nobody can look in somebody's mind to know why a crime was committed, but prosecutors usually try to do that.
No, I completely agree. I completely agree. And I feel like they're creating these stories, and whether or not they care about, you know, the Ray Crones, they should care about the people out there, at least if somebody is wrongfully convicted, that that other person who actually did it is committing more crimes. And it's, you know, sometimes I feel like the law enforcement has their opinions about people they deem as criminals. And it's almost like they convince themselves so far that this is the person who did it, that they're able to persuade these juries, that they're able to, they just start to believe it so wholeheartedly that this must be the answer, that they're not even bending and opening up to the possibility that it was someone else who's still out there causing more crime.
Yeah, and I think this is a perfect example of tunnel vision. These detectives working the case came up with a suspect just based solely on this diary and focused in on him right away and then ignored all the other possibilities out there. Like, hey, there was a sex offender living two blocks away from the crime scene and he just got out on parole. Wouldn't that be a big red flag out there? Like, hey, let's take a look at him.
Yeah, the person who's actually a criminal.